All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Mary J. Schoen presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. My name is Judge Schoen. My right is Judge Gartley. My left is Judge Meredith. I'd like to thank NOVA for having us here today. We're here to hear the case of John B. Spaner, Jr. versus Robert L. Wilkie, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 16-2811E. Would counsel for each party please note their appearance for the record?
Bart Stichman, counsel for Spaner.
Caitlin
Milo,
counsel for Spaker.
Julie Turner, on behalf of the Secretary.
Christopher Walsh.
Thank you. Does the Appellant's counsel wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes, please.
Thank you. You may be getting ready.
Judge Schoen, may it please the court. Ms. Milo and I represent John Spaner. The dispute before the court today involves an application for attorney's fees for over $11,000. It is contested by the Secretary on only one ground. The local CPI rate for calculating the hourly rate for compensating two of the five advocates who seek compensation for their work on a common successful appeal to this court. Advocates employed by two law firms representing Mr. Spaner in this appeal, the National Veterans Legal Services Program and Wilmer Hale LLP. Compensation is sought for one attorney employed by the Boston office of Wilmer Hale, and three attorneys and one paralegal employed by the Washington, D.C. office of NVLSP. The Secretary contests the hourly rate sought for two of NVLSP's attorneys, Caitlin Milo and Rory Ryan, on the ground that their hourly rates were calculated using the allegedly wrong local cost of living index. According to the Secretary, the appropriate cost of living index is the one covering where they were physically located when they worked on this case, in New Jersey or North Carolina, rather than the Washington, D.C. location of their office of their employer. The lead case involving the appropriate CPI UDUs under the EJ in a case before this court is the Federal Circuit's decision last year in Parrot v. Schulter.
If I can stop you there, Mr. Sussman, how does using the employer's office location to determine the CPI used to calculate an attorney's rate square with Parrot and Menino that state that the CPI is selected based on where the attorney does the work?
There are two parts of Parrot which I think answer that question. First, let's look at the actual specific holding in Parrot. The Federal Circuit relied on the fact that during his work on the case, Parrot's attorney, Mr. Atte, worked in and maintained distinct offices in San Francisco, Dallas, and Little Rock. Based only on these facts, the Federal Circuit held that the Veterans Court properly concluded that Parrot's fee application should be apportioned among Mr. Atte's 42 billing entries to the firm's location where the work was performed. That holding was in turn based on the Federal Circuit's primary holding that the Veterans Court was correct to reject the use of a national CPI and instead use a local CPI under the report, and what they said is, we believe using the market rate and cost of living actually experienced by each applicant's attorney is most consistent with EJIA. So the issue before the court boils down to the question, what location is associated with the market rate and cost of living actually experienced by Attorney Mario and his rival? Now, to answer that question, I believe there are two underlying questions that need to be answered. First, is the cost of living actually experienced by attorneys Milo or Lori the cost associated with her personal non-work activities like housing, food, clothing, and entertainment, or the cost associated with her legal work on the case? And second, if the answer is the costs associated with her legal work, what are those costs and where are they experienced? But let me take that first question first. I submit that the cost of living actually experienced by the attorney refers to the costs associated with the attorney's legal work on the case. And there are two reasons that I say that, and both of them derive from Parrott. First, Parrott makes clear that Mr. Atkins' personal living expenses, where he resides, like housing, clothing, food, and entertainment, are not what is relevant. There's no evidence in the Parrott record regarding where Mr. Atkins lived, only evidence of where his office was when he did his work. Thus, for all the federal circuit knew, Mr. Atkins' sole personal residence was in San Francisco, where he incurred his personal non-work expenses. Yet Parrott teaches that Mr. Atkins should be compensated using a Little Rock CPIU for his work in his office there.
But the CPIU is generally described as food, covering food, clothing, shelter, and other goods and services. At least that's the way most cases describe it. I'm assuming that comes right from the CPIU itself. So what kind of food and clothing would be associated with, under your argument, legal work?
No. It's true that the CPIU is focused on the goods and services you talked about. That is the proxy that Congress used in deciding when in using to calculate what rate should be provided to the attorney above $125 an hour. But that doesn't mean, that doesn't tell you where the location of those, of the CPIU should be located. And so I think the ruling in power, focusing on where his office was, as opposed to where his personal living was, is one of the reasons that you should focus on.
It wasn't just where his office was, it was where he also did work at those offices.
He worked at those offices, but he worked at
those
offices.
And that was the element of that being
there. Yes, the location of the person when they worked.
In your briefing, you point to the fact that NBLSP provides, at the very least, one of the attorneys was a computer and maintains that computer, and correspondence is processed through the Washington, D.C. address, and other sorts of logistical support happen there.
Correct.
What if that wasn't the case? What if you happen to employ an attorney and they live somewhere remotely and their mail gets sent to them and they do all their own work, they just happen to be an employee of a particular law firm? Would that make a difference such that you're not really incurring overhead, which I think is sort of the idea that you're trying to get at?
Yes, it would make a difference.
So
if we were employing an attorney whose office had all the accoutrements of the overhead and support staff that's built into an attorney's market rate, then I think the result would be different.
And so the court is put in a position of having to peer into the operations of a particular firm to see how they apportion the work, the support work, and the financial investment in the tools that the attorney team?
I think that's part of the burden of the applicant. The applicant, if it's using an attorney who's in a different location, and it's up to the applicant to provide the court with the information that tells the court where are the costs for providing the legal work located, where they occur.
What if a law firm had multiple locations? The attorney never worked at any of them. They always teleworked from a different geographic region, and their work was potentially supported by different folks at different offices or whatever. How would you figure out which CPI you need to use?
That's a tough question. I don't know if that situation ever exists, but if it does, I don't know what I would do as the applicant. I'd probably use a combination of the different offices that provide support. But that's not the case here. I hear that might be a problem in that sort of very complex case.
If I could.
Yes.
In your pleadings, you talk about that the key question here is the actual cost of living experienced by these attorneys, but if I understand your argument correctly, you want us to look exclusively at their employer in deciding which CPIU we should use, at the overhead costs of NDLSP in DC, and not look at all at where the work was performed or the cost of living that these individuals personally experience in their own community. Is that, how do you get to taking the individual attorney out of the equation?
No, the individual attorney's salary is part of the equation. The individual attorney's benefits is part of the equation. And the support staff and overhead.
How is the salary you pay to the attorney relevant to what cost of living they're experiencing?
As I said, the cost of living they're experiencing in terms of personal expenses, their personal living expenses, I don't think we're part of the equation. And let me provide a second rationale for Parrott that helps demonstrate that. Parrott, in deciding that the cost of living index to use should be local and not national, emphasized the purposes underpinning the EJIP, which the court identified as ensuring adequate compensation is available to encourage attorneys to represent those needing to vindicate their rights and to prevent windfalls to attorneys paid out of the public fist. It said the local CPIU approach, where costs may exceed the national rates, help ensure that lawyers are not undercompensated, deterring them from representing those in need. Similarly, the local CPI approach prevents windfalls to attorneys whose cost of living is below the national average. Now, this leads to the conclusion, I believe, also leads to the conclusion that it's the cost of providing legal work and where those costs are incurred that's the key. NDLSP's fee agreements are undoubtedly the same as other fee agreements and appeals before this court, in that the client agrees that any EJIP fee awards will be paid not to the individual attorneys, like attorney Milo, who work on the case, but paid directly to the law firm that employs the attorney. So the parrot, if the law firm is not compensated based on the costs that it, the law firm, actually experiences in doing its work on the case, and is instead compensated by an index for costs that are less expensive, it will undercompensate the firm and tend to discourage it from representing those in need, which is an underpinning to the EJIP that motivated the panel and power to rule the way they did. Conversely, if the law firm representing the debtor is compensated based on an index for cost in a more expensive location, then what the law firm actually experiences the costs allowing it to represent the debtor, it will provide a windfall to the law firm to take that to the public fist. So Carrick makes clear by focusing on where Mr. Atkins' office was, associated with an office, and being consistent, using a CPI location that's consistent with the purpose of each, I believe leads to the conclusion that it's talking about the costs experienced by the attorney in legal work. When I take an Amtrak train from Washington, D.C. to New York, I don't know when I'm 30th Street Station in Philadelphia for my time using the CPI for Philadelphia, because I'm in that location at the time, or 10 stations in New York. I use the Washington, D.C. CPIU when I'm billing my time under the EJIA, because that's where the costs were incurred, not the physical location where I was.
If you're just temporarily in the train station, how are you actually experiencing the cost of living in that location?
That's my point. I'm not experiencing the costs associated with providing legal work in that location. I'm physically there.
But where you work and where you live, do you not experience the cost of living there?
I experience both living expenses with my personal residence, and the costs of providing legal work are incurred by the office in Washington, D.C.
Well, I didn't get the impression that the secretary's position was that an attorney should go under the CPIU where the work was done, like if they took a two-day trip somewhere and did some work while they were there. I don't think that's the secretary's position. It sounds as though you're kind of like straining it out and saying basically it's under the secretary's argument. You would, you know, an attorney would have to keep track of everywhere they went and where they did work. I was not under the impression that that was the secretary's argument. His argument seemed to be based on where a person's residence is, where they're located,
when they did the work.
Right.
And so
their address, where they, you know, in Attorney Motto's case, it would be Sweetville, Pennsylvania. Even though she might have taken a trip up to the Poconos for a day and done 2 hours of work there. I mean, I did not get the impression that the secretary's argument was, that level of like where you do the work, but where your office is located. And Attorney Milo's office is in her home, apparently.
I believe her office in the way that the Federal Circuit is using the term office is not in Sweetsboro, New Jersey. She's a virtual attorney whose office is in Washington, D.C. She works out of a room in her house that she calls her guest room, and she uses a computer purchased by MPSP to log into the internet, to go to GoToMyPC, which is a software program that allows her to get into MPLSP's computer and server in Washington, D.C. that we pay for in Washington, D.C. And it's as if she's sitting there in Washington, D.C. doing her work.
But aren't your costs different for Attorney Milo sitting in her guest room in Sweetsboro, that you don't have to pay overhead for an office for her like you do for another attorney who's sitting down the hall from you in Washington?
I think there is some difference in there. We do have a workstation that she can work at. Ms. Milo was here in Washington, D.C. yesterday and worked in an office that had one other attorney in it.
Is that space dedicated to her, or do you have other folks who use it because they telework or whatever come in on her?
Yeah, she might not be in the same location every time she comes in.
So you're not incurring a dedicated cost for space for her, for example?
We're incurring a cost that for people who work for us that come into the office from time to time. So
the main problem I'm having that I'm hoping you can address is when the statute talks about cost of living, it seems to be referring to an individual attorney. And the way you are arguing, you're kind of trying to attribute cost of living expenses to an entity such as NDLSP. I'm not, where does that come from? I mean, doesn't the statute read as though it's talking about an individual attorney regardless of the fact that they work for an entity? They're talking about the attorney.
And the attorney is employed by the law firm. The fee agreement, the retainer, is with the law firm, not the attorney. And so the client is employing the law firm. That's what the fee agreement said. And that's why when fees are awarded, the award goes to the law firm. The law firm employs attorneys who work on the case. But I think the practical implication of the legal profession and the way it works is that the law firm is the entity in interest in ensuring, and that's being, it's their viewpoint on whether they're being properly compensated. That will affect whether they represent those who meet the underlying purpose of the agent.
I guess I just see it as problematic because an entity doesn't incur a lot of costs of living that an individual would, such as I mentioned earlier, the food and the clothing. I mean, unless
that's true. The CPIU, although it does include legal services as one of the factors that affects the CPIU, it also talks about costs of clothing and housing that you wouldn't think apply to a law firm, but it's just a proxy for how you add to the $125 an hour. It doesn't tell you where the location is of those costs. And the location of the costs, I believe, are the location of the costs of the legal services you provide. Otherwise, you would not be following, as I mentioned, about the law firm being undercompensated or overcompensated if you use a CPI that's not located where the law firm incurs the law firm's costs in providing services.
Well, wouldn't there be a unfair disparity between a sole practitioner who lives in Swedesboro, Pennsylvania, and practices veterans law and submits EJA applications and uses the CPIU for the Philly area versus attorney Milo, who is, even though she's living in Swedesboro, is allowed to use the CPIU for the Washington, D.C. area. It just seems like the sole practitioner under your argument moves out somehow. It just doesn't seem consistent.
I hear what you're saying, and here's my answer. The sole practitioner in Swedesboro is incurring the cost of legal work in Swedesboro. And so it's being paid at the Swedesboro rate. The attorney Milo is all her legal work, in effect. The costs of them are incurred in Washington, D.C., not in Swedesboro, a more expensive location. Therefore, the same costs cost the law firm more than the solo practitioner in Swedesboro. Because Swedesboro is the location of the incurrence of the costs of providing legal services for the solo practitioner. Not true in Attorney Milo's case.
And if Attorney Milo lived in New York City, which I didn't check on this, I'm assuming it has a higher cost of living than Washington, D.C., and you were submitting an EJA petition, you would use the Washington, D.C., even though she lives in New York City.
Exactly right.
That's what you're right.
For example, we have an attorney who lives in Columbia, Maryland, who works for us sometimes in Columbia, sometimes in Washington, D.C. It turns out they changed the CPIU locations so that Columbia, Maryland has a different CPIU than Washington, D.C., and it's now greater than it would be in Washington, D.C. We're not going to charge, depending on the ruling of the court, Columbia, Maryland higher CPIU rates for her when all the costs associated with the legal work are in Washington, D.C.
Doesn't your argument, isn't it kind of subject to, it just seems like it would be problematic. What if you decided you wanted to move to Florida, and all the other attorneys wanted to live elsewhere outside of D.C.? So no one was working inside of D.C., but you could all, is your argument that basically, even though you had a firm that was incorporated in D.C., which has a fairly high CPIU, you were already elsewhere because you had like a shell office in D.C., you could use the D.C. CPIU?
No, that's not my position. The wave of the future seems to be virtual attorneys. Let me amend your facts a little bit. Use your example and then use a different example. If all the support staff and all the computers and all the financial workers were in the Washington, D.C. office and all these virtual workers were in their home and they worked, and so the costs and they were paid by the Washington, D.C. office, then the Washington, D.C. CPIU would be appropriate. If, however, it's a shell office, and there's nothing there, no expenses are being incurred, except maybe for one-room office space or a post office box. The costs aren't being incurred there. Somebody is providing the support services and the overhead someplace else.
We added 8 additional minutes to your opposing counsel's time. I understand you do not have a timer in front of you, but additional time will be granted to you if necessary.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please report? The Secretary's position is that an attorney should be compensated based on the local rate where he or she municipally works. An attorney who's living in Statesboro, New Jersey, or Charlotte, North Carolina is not only less expensive to hire from a client's perspective, but it's also paying less for her goods and services and in that local community than she would be in Washington, D.C. It's not only plausible, but it's also logical that the cost of living adjustment is most accurately measured by looking to the actual cost of living that's experienced by an attorney where she's performing the work. The work by attorneys Milo O'Reilly in this case was conducted outside of Washington, D.C., and so their billing rate should not reflect the D.C. locality.
If I can interrupt, getting back to Parrott, in Parrott, Mr. Attig billed exclusively from the Washington, D.C. CPIU when he submitted his EJA application, and the court later said it had to be only the locations of his offices where he did work, but did not include Washington, D.C. as one of the locations. So where the attorney did his work wasn't the key factor for the court. So how do you reconcile the fact that Ms. Milo has an office in D.C. but did work elsewhere?
Well, In Parrott, the court's focus seemed to be on where the predominant place of business is. So where the prevailing market is in a certain community amplified by the cost of living in that community. I think the statute generally assumes that someone will work and live generally within the same geographic region. In this case, in this case, Attorney Milo, as you mentioned, is working from an office that is inside her home. And this is her predominant place of business. This is where the hours that she is working, that she is within the LSP, are generally occurring. So her primary place of business being in Speedsboro, New Jersey, and then her also experiencing the cost of living in terms of the clothes that she's buying and the food that she's buying, when she's paying for car insurance or going to buy a gallon of milk at the grocery store, all of this is the cost of living that she is actually experiencing in her locality.
It doesn't seem like the court in Parrott cared where Mr. Atwick lived and what costs he incurred in buying groceries or clothing or car insurance. They looked at where the firm had offices.
Well, Your Honor, the court did say that the appropriate measure would be where an attorney lives and has an office. And in this case, it appears that the attorneys live and have offices outside of Washington, D.C. So I don't think that the idea of the prevailing market rate and cost of living can be completely divorced, but I also don't think that it's appropriate for a firm to be able to say that the only measure should be institutional practices. Rather, the individual's experience should be taken into account. If the individual attorney is experiencing cost of living, a term that this court in Elsasson has defined as meaning, again, shelter, food, clothing, other basic goods and services, then that's a consumer-centric inquiry that has to do with a specific individual. And if the going rate for an attorney in Speedsboro, New Jersey is going to be less than the going rate for an attorney in Washington, D.C., then the prevailing market rate for an attorney in a less expensive city should govern, and therefore the amplification, as my colleague Mr. Stichman mentioned, the cost of living should also be attached to where the prevailing market rate is initially established.
Well, if we take your position about the cost experienced by the attorney, what if an attorney for NVLSP lived in West Virginia and commuted into D.C.? Their home, their clothing purchases, their food purchases, or whatever, are all going to be in West Virginia, which I'm assuming has a lower CPIU than the D.C. market. So shouldn't we be looking at where the attorney lives then, because that's what their actual costs are? That hypothetical attorney in my case is not the one that's procuring office space, is not the one that is buying a computer, is not the one that is buying Westlaw services. So all those costs that you seem to not be accounting for are occurring in a cheaper market. So how do we reconcile that?
I believe that the primary place of business, that is where an attorney is typically conducting work, should govern the locality rate. There are many instances, particularly in an advancing technological age, where there may be an attorney who commutes a long way to come into the office. And in that instance, there would be higher transportation costs, which would also add to the cost of living. So assuming that the person might be commuting from West Virginia with a lower CPI into DC with a higher CPI, again, the transportation costs of their commute would be factored into their cost of living. And so it may be actually more logical and fair to apply the cost of living for D.C., even though the person isn't living there. But again, the Secretary would pretend that the most relevant inquiry would be a primary place of business. Whereas in the current case, there may be more than one primary place of business. If there are multiple offices where an attorney is typically conducting work, then the local CPI, where the office is located, should govern. But in the event that there was, I think there was a hypothetical earlier about multiple firm offices throughout the country, and an attorney is working 100% remotely, and perhaps the support services, the cost of those services are being shared throughout the firm generally, then it really opens up the question of how to compensate for that attorney's time, because it's not clear which office they would necessarily be exclusively supported by, and it seems that the fairer and more clear measure would be to specifically specifically looks where the attorney is located to reduce the amount of each litigation and to reduce the potential for evidentiary hearings and fact-finding and parsing out exactly, or we want to use maybe some sort of hybrid between where the firm is located and where the attorney is located. And this would also solve the problem of shifting the focus over exclusively to overhead costs of the firm to try to justify costs of living. If a firm is spending money on support services for an attorney, but maybe they're not entirely using their overhead costs for an attorney, as you mentioned, they're not necessarily paying for an office that's dedicated to Ms. Meyer or Ms. Riley. And you can even look to, as Mr. Sitchin mentioned, the new technological age, maybe 100% remote firm, maybe share legal secretarial services, maybe outsourcing things like IT to other parts of the country or even outside of the country. If you're reducing the overhead costs so much, then does it really make sense to have overhead costs be really the guiding factor in determining global CPI? Because it can be variable.
Well, but when a veteran hires NVLSP, they hire NVLSP. They're not necessarily hiring Ms. Milo, right? So the cost to the veteran to procure legal services is the cost that NVLSP incurs, or is it the cost that Ms. Milo incurs? Since the veteran doesn't care in the marketplace, no offense to Ms. Milo, whether he gets hurt or not. Or she gets her.
A client will be, if we can assume that a client expects reasonable fees and that the government is stepping into the shoes of the client and has the same expectation of reasonable fees, then I don't believe that a client would expect to have the same billing rate for an attorney in D.C. if the attorney is not in D.C. Would a client go to a Washington, D.C. firm and then expect to pay for a smaller town attorney? If the attorney is living in rural Mississippi and they never or rarely come into D.C. and all the work associated with the case is done in rural Mississippi, then would a client have a reasonable expectation of paying a full market rate for a D.C. attorney? How is that justified? To the extent that NVLSP is making a business decision to pay its attorneys at a D.C. rate, even though the attorneys aren't experiencing that cost of living themselves, and even though an attorney in these locations may not necessarily cost that much for a client in that location to hire, the secretary can't speak to that business practice, but it does not seem as a reasonable cost to pass on to the taxpayer. Mr. Stichman mentioned that there are two pitfalls that this court would warn against, and one would be the unfairness to a fee petitioner and calculating a local CPI if their local rate exceeded the national average, but also to prevent a windfall to an attorney in the event that their local CPI was less than a national average. And I think that the same logic would apply in this case. If there is a firm that's in a small town, I would say that the secretary would readily concede that if a firm is in a less expensive city and an attorney is remotely working in a more expensive city, then the more expensive city's CPI should govern, and that an attorney who's working in New York should be getting a higher CPI billing rate than the attorney who's working for maybe where the firm is located in a less expensive city. But if a firm is located in a less expensive city and they would like to procure talent from a larger city, there are many attorneys in big cities, there's a lot of law schools there, if they would like to give out the opportunity to attract talent from these cities, then should they not be allowed to compensate the attorney for their going rate or what was more appropriate for them?
But would that be a reasonable fee for a client who walks into a small town firm in Mississippi expecting to pay Mississippi billing rates to suddenly be billed at a New York City shoe law firm rate? Would that be a reasonable cost to expect?
Well, assuming that the firm has discussed with the client that there was an attorney that they would like to maybe contract for this case, and that there's a reason that they would like to use an attorney who's more expensive, and I assume that's a discussion between
then why wouldn't that be also a reasonable conversation for a client of NVLSP's to have had that you're going to get an attorney that may be billing at a higher rate even though she lives in a less expensive location?
Because it's not justified in that case. You can justify to a client in rural Mississippi that you want a New York attorney who will pay more because the cost of living is more. When they buy it out, it costs more. But does any of those have the same justification when a client comes in and they say, this attorney wouldn't necessarily cost as much, but we'd have to pay them just as much anyway?
Well, I'm not going to dispute Ms. Milo's value on this.
The small town firm that lives in that or located in a less expensive area would not necessarily be able to attract the same talent if they're not able to compensate at the same rate. And similarly, in this case, it seems to be creating a windfall to the attorney because Ms. Milo is on a day-to-day basis experiencing a lower cost of living and a client in her locality who typically be paying less for her services, but she's also being compensated at a DC rate, then does this not fit into the category of creating a windfall that makes it be unreasonable for the special career village?
Could I get you to respond to the conversation we were having earlier about whether you would have to track, for based on where the work was performed, whether you would have to track how many hours you spent at the train station and where you were on vacation? Could you respond to that as to what the secretary's position is?
Yes, and Judge Bartley, for her intuitiveness in saying that the secretary was not suggesting that when an attorney is on an Amtrak train or they're spending a couple hours doing work in an off location, that they would have to track these hours. That's not what we're looking for in a situation like this. It is a primary place of business. So, to use the example of this case, Ms. Riley, I believe, billed less than an hour in this case. And in the event that perhaps she had been, working from her mother's house in New York or maybe she was on vacation in Florida, if that was the situation, then we would not contest reasonableness of her using a CPI from Charlotte, North Carolina. It would seem more appropriate that if that is her primary place of business, then that is the local CPI that she would be using in her job applications.
What if an attorney were to work 50% of their time from their home in West Virginia and 50% of their time from their office in VLSP? And VLSP had a dedicated office for them, but they also provided them computer space and support and things at their home office. So the costs really are pretty much 50-50. And they're paid by the law firm. They're, Mr. Shishman described, on the fee agreement, it's MBLSP, the fee gets paid to MBLSP. So how would you figure out what the primary place of business in that instance?
Your Honor, that's a good question. I don't have a perfect answer. The statute was created long before any of this were, any of these were relevant concerns. If the attorney is, assuming that everything is equally divided completely, which I feel that in most circumstances one will tend to lean more than the other, but if an attorney has two primary places of business, then it would seem that she could bill hours at each location if they're both legitimately primary places of business where she's typically going.
So the parent model.
Yes, that's correct. If your honors have any other questions? Mm-hmm. The secretary would ask that this court reject any less PC job application insofar as it is requested to see the locality for attorneys and other rights.
You have 10 minutes.
I just have a couple of points, Your Honor. I think government counsel spoke about what Parra said, that it's where her attorneys lived. Parra talks about where her attorney worked and maintained distinct offices. We talked about CPIU and that it focuses on things like housing and food and entertainment, but there are other factors that it measures that are the type of factors that relate to the cost of the legal services provided, like postage and delivery services, telephone services, cost of computers, internet services, and legal services. So those are also included in the CPIU. It is true applications on that. It's something the board needs to do. What is the prevailing market rate, et cetera. So that's always going to be a part of the function of the court in a fee application. And it's the burden of the fee applicant to provide the court with the information necessary to decide that issue. So I don't think, no matter what the court decides in this case, it's going to change that fact.
Do you know where Mr. Atik lived during the time of the barricades? Was that in the
pleadings? I don't have any idea. But that was not important to the court. It never said that that was information the court needed. It was only where he worked and in the office he worked in. And I don't think it's fair to say that Ms. Milo, her costs were incurred in Sweetsboro, New Jersey. All of the costs were really the location of the costs were in Washington, D.C. She logs into the server in Washington, D.C. Her telephone is purchased in Washington, D.C. And the phone calls come in Washington, D.C. and are automatically sent to her phone. And if she doesn't answer, the voicemail system in the Washington, D.C. office takes the voicemail message, and she calls into that Washington, D.C. telephone system to get a voicemail. All of the support staff on mail is in Washington, D.C. They open our mail, they scan, and do all the other support services that are required. And so I think it will discourage or provide windfalls if you focus on where the person lived at the time they provided legal services in a situation where all the costs are borne by the law firm and the law firm's location of their office.
Thank you very much. Thank you. The case will be submitted for a decision. The court is now adjourned. We'll come down and greet counsel.
All rise.